da ba la ba giri ba da da di. Da da ba la ba giri ba da da di. Yashoda nandana braja jana ranjana. Yashoda nandana braja jana ranjana. Yamuna tira banachari. Yamuna tira banachari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjari Hari. Gopi Jana Balaba Giri Badadadi. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Ranjana. Yamuna Tira Badachari. Jayarada Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jayarada Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jana Balaba Giri Badadari. Gopi Jana Balaba Giri Badadari. Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Yashoda Nandana Braja Jana Randana. Yamuna Tira Banachari. Yamuna Tira Banachari. Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari. Jaya Radha Madhava Kunjabi Hari.
Jai Om Vishnupad, Paramahamsa Paribharaja Kacharyara, Stitara Sadasu Sriman, His Divine Grace A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai. Sri Sri Gaunitai Ki Jai. Sri Sri Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Devi Ki Jai. Sri Sri Rukmini Dwarkadish Ki Jai. Go Premanandi. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to the assembled devotees. All glories to Sri Guru and Gauranga, Go Premanandi. Hare Krishna. So instead of the usual Bhagavad Gita class, tonight and tomorrow night, we'll be having this seminar, Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. So just to give a little introduction, this is based on a diary that I was keeping when I was traveling with Srila Prabhupada. That was from November of 1975 through the end of March of 1977. So about 16 months altogether. And then there's a few extra things that I've included where I felt it was appropriate on particular topics. So what I've done is, instead, rather than this being a chronological presentation, I've taken different subjects or topics of devotional life, and whatever Prabhupada said or whatever he did on that particular topic, I've tried to compile that into, you know, some kind of ordered sequence so that you can get a more focused and intimate look at that aspect of devotional activity. Of course, this is not meant to present everything that Prabhupada ever said or did on that particular topic. This is just a synopsis. It gives a glimpse, and I think it gives a fairly good idea of how Prabhupada was applying Krishna conscious philosophy in everyday circumstances in the modern age. Of course, this is 1970, now it's 2007. So that's 30 years ago, but it's still pretty much, I think, we're facing the same, you know, circumstances for executing our devotional service that we did in the 1970s. What's that shouting? Somebody can stop that. So this, as I say, is called Srila Prabhupada, the Living Bhagavatam. And if we look at ISKCON, ISKCON is nothing except whatever Srila Prabhupada said it should be. He was the founder of Acharya. He made this movement exactly in the way that he wanted. The standards that he established were carefully thought out. They were evolved in some ways according to time, place, and circumstance. And Prabhupada's own unique ability to spread Krishna consciousness throughout all the different cultures of the world, but still retain the same high spiritual standards that are demanded of pure devotional service. So in that sense then, you know, this is, as I say, it's not just the Bhagavatam, because in the Bhagavatam, if you read a book, then there are so many different ways, according to your own mentality, that you can interpret something and apply it. That's natural. And of course that gradually leads to degradation, because then you get mundane people that read and then interpret in their own way, and gradually you end up with something which is exactly the opposite to what the book is actually saying. That we have, you know, with the Bhagavad Gita, Srimad Bhagavatam, where just the text is there, and then you get the impersonalists, the Mayavadis, they come along, they give their own ideas of what the text means, and you end up with something which is totally the opposite to Sarvadharmam Parijagya Mamikam Saranam Braja. So therefore Krishna says, Yoga Nashta Parantapa, this science, as time goes by, it becomes lost, it becomes spoiled, and then it has to be re-established. So Srila Prabhupada, as all of the Acharyas have done, he established or maintained the principles of pure devotional service for the time, place, and circumstance that he was preaching in. And in that sense, because he was living the Bhagavatam, therefore the message was preserved and its original potency has its immediate effect. So, as I say, I joined Prabhupada's party in late 1975, just at the end of November. Srila Prabhupada had come back to Delhi from a trip down to South Africa and Mauritius, and he had come back to Bombay, and then he came up to New Delhi with the intention of meeting with a big politician there. His name was Gulzarilal Nanda, he was developing Kurukshetra. If you go to Kurukshetra nowadays, you'll see that actually the facilities there for the pilgrims are very nice. They made a lot of effort, spent a lot of money providing proper bathing areas, etc., and the whole area has become quite nicely developed. So at this time in 1974-75, this man, Gosaralal Nanda, was in charge of that development in Kurukshetra. And Srila Prabhupada was interested in getting some land there so that he could build a Varnashram college. He had a plan and he had money. Ambarish Prabhu, he had flown into Nairobi when Prabhupada was there in Africa. And then he came with Srila Prabhupada to India and then up to Delhi. So he had donated $150,000 so that Prabhupada could build this Varnashram college. And Prabhupada had met with Nanda previously, and he had been to Kurukshetra, so, you know, he had some idea what was going on there. So he had made an arrangement that in the future we'll meet again, and then I'll come with you to Kurukshetra. You can take me around, and then we'll pick some land. So this was the time when Prabhupada was going to do that. Now, when he arrived in Delhi, then he was going to be there 1 or 2 days. It wasn't quite fixed up exactly when Nandaji was going to be there also. And in the meantime, because of events in Africa, things were not going on quite so well as Prabhupada hoped they would, especially in Kenya and like this. So Prabhupada had actually sent his secretary, Brahmananda, who was the GBC for Africa, he sent him back to Africa. When they came back to Bombay, then again he sent Brahmananda back. Not only him, but two others who he had just given sannyas to, Nandakumar and Navayogendra. So both of those men had previously been Prabhupada's personal servants. Of course, Nandakumar, that was quite some years before. I remember in 1972, the first time I saw Srila Prabhupada was in Sydney. So when he arrived in Sydney, that was on his second visit to Australia. And his servant was Nandakumar. And his secretary was Shamasunda, and he had Pradyumna also doing his Sanskrit work. So at the end of 75, anyway, Nandakumar had had a few problems. And he was doing some business anyway. And he happened to be in India, and he turned up in Bombay. And then when he came to see Srila Prabhupada, he told Prabhupada, Prabhupada asked him, what are you doing? And then he said, I'm doing this business selling herbs. He was getting some Ayurvedic herbs and shipping them over. Some people said that he might have been selling some other kind of herbs as well. But anyway, Prabhupada, you know, when he heard that, he said, if you do this business, you will go to hell. So Nandakumar was shocked. And he said, well, Prabhupada, what should I do? And then Prabhupada told him, take sannyas. So he immediately gave him sannyas. And he sent him to Africa with Brahmananda. And then at the same time, there was Navayogendra. He had been on Prabhupada's party just briefly around Janmashtami time when Prabhupada was in Vrindavan. When Prabhupada went to Africa, he had left Navayogendra in Bombay. So when he came back, he gave him sannyas also, along with Nandakumar, and the two of them were sent to Africa. So when Prabhupada came up to Delhi, he only had Harikesh with him on his party. Harikesh was doing the transcribing of Prabhupada's tapes, and he was doing his cooking, but he was fairly busy and he wasn't able to do the other services, or a few things, but not the massage and things like this. So Prabhupada didn't have a personal servant. Hansaduta had been contacted. He flew in and met Srila Prabhupada in Delhi and became the secretary for that month. So as it stood on November the 25th, then Prabhupada was there, but he didn't have a personal servant. Now there were two other personal servants that were in Vrindavan at that time. One of them was Upendra Prabhu, and the other was Nittai Das. So they both came into Delhi to see Prabhupada when he arrived, but neither of them was staying. Upendra had got a ticket. He was supposed to be going to Fiji to do some preaching. He had been with Prabhupada when he came into Vrindavan at Janmashtami time, and so was Nittai, but the two of them had remained in Vrindavan when Prabhupada went on to Africa. So now, finally, after a couple of months of waiting, Upendra got his ticket to Fiji, and he was due to fly out the next day. So he wasn't available. He did Prabhupada's massage the first 2 days there in Delhi, but he was flying out. And then Nittai also was not available. He had stayed behind in Vrindavan to learn Sanskrit and to work on developing the new Gurukul and also improve the deity worship standards there. So he had come into Delhi, but he had to leave immediately because he was on his way to Bombay to get his visa extended. He had some, maybe it was just run out, and he had to get it extended. So he also couldn't remain. So out of four previous servants, not one of them was available. They were, you know, two off to Africa, and the others had their own business to do. So I just happened to be in Delhi on that particular day. When Prabhupada arrived, I'd come in on some personal business, and I wasn't expecting to stay. I was going to return the same evening. And then Gopal Krishna, who was an adhikari at that time, bless him, he told me that I want you to stay in Delhi for the few days that Prabhupada's here and be his door guard. So, you know, I thought, what does Prabhupada need a door guard for in Delhi? Maybe if he was, you know, in some place like America or something, you know, he might need one. But in the middle of Delhi, it's unlikely. But at the same time, I was also thinking, well, this is, you know, fantastic. If I sit at Prabhupada's door all day, I'll get to see him. You know, he's bound to come in and out at some point, and I'll be there for the afternoon darshans. So I was really, really happy that, you know, I got this little service. So I stayed there in Delhi for a couple of days. Anyway, what happened was that because Upendra was leaving, then there was some discussion between Srila Prabhupada and Harikesh. And so on the 26th, I was sitting in the temple chanting my rounds. This was about midday. And Harikesh suddenly turned up. Of course, in those days, the Delhi temple was not the big grand affair that we have now. It was a place that could have fitted into about half of this room. You know, the old Todamol Lane Bengali Markets temple. Tiny, tiny little place. No room for Prabhupada to stay. He was staying further down the road at number 9. The temple was at number 19. And there was a small flat there that Tejas was living in. So he vacated that to let Prabhupada stay there. So I was in the temple there. And then Harikesh popped his head in. He gave me a very kind of intense look. And then he asked me, do you know how to do massage? And I said, no, I've never done it in my life. And then he said, well, Upendra's leaving tomorrow. He's massaging Prabhupada right now. He's up on the roof. You have to go up there and watch him how he does it because you're going to be doing it tomorrow. And that was it. So, naturally, I wasn't going to argue with that. I didn't believe it, frankly. I really didn't, you know, believe it. But I ran down the road and I ran up the steps, came out onto the roof, and sure enough, there Srila Prabhupada was being massaged by Upendra. So at that point, then I actually realized something is really happening here and I'm not actually, you know, imagining this. So I offered my obeisances and sat down to watch. And then Prabhupada had his eyes closed. Then after about, you know, 1 or 2 minutes, he suddenly opened his eyes. He saw me sitting there and he, you know, kind of tipped his head. Yes. So the way that he said it, it was kind of ambiguous. So I had a doubt then whether I'd really heard what Harikesh had told me was really true or not. So I said, well, you know, Harikesh told me Upendra's leaving tomorrow and you need somebody to do your massage and I have to come up and watch him how he does it. No, Prabhupada just, you know, waggled his head in that Indian way. And, okay, Yes. And then he closed his eyes and that was it. He never said another word for the rest of the massage. So I just sat there and watched. And then after about an hour or so, then Prabhupada got up, he went down, and Upendra took 2 minutes just to explain to me how to do Prabhupada's massage, you know, what order to do it in and which oils to use, and that was it. Anyway, and then he told me, now there's an evening massage. At that point, I actually didn't even know that Prabhupada had an evening massage. I was completely ignorant about what went on in Prabhupada's quarters, as most of us were. You know, usually we would see Prabhupada on the morning walks and on the Vyasasan, and that was probably it. Although in India, you could get in for darshans. But by and large, it was a very formal, you know, kind of situation. And what went on, you know, on a daily basis in Prabhupada's rooms, only a few people knew. The people on his party, maybe, you know, his GBCs, even them, they only went in when they were called for. So it was a bit of a mystery, to me at least. And when he told me, you come at 9 o'clock tonight to do Prabhupada's evening massage, I was surprised. I didn't know that there was such a thing. Anyway, so it was made clear to me that you're only going to do this for a couple of days, just as a fill-in. And when Prabhupada goes to Vrindavan after he's here, then he's going to go to Kurukshetra for one day with Nandaji. And then after that, he's going to Vrindavan. So it was made very clear to me that you're not going to do this in Vrindavan. You know, this is just for Delhi, only the massage, nothing else. Don't get attached. That was, you know, Harikesh and Gopal Krishna. And Gopal Krishna had got this idea in his mind that I would be a very good temple president for Calcutta. So I'd only been in India about 2 or 3 months at that point. And I thought the whole idea of me going to Calcutta to be the new temple president was absolutely absurd. But that was India in those days. You know, whoever walked through the door, you were immediately, you know, put in some position or another. I mean, it happened to me literally when I had arrived in India at the end of July or early August in 75. I'd gone there to join the Vrindavan temple, and literally as I walked through the front gate, I was grabbed, taken into the temple president's office and appointed the new temple commander for the, you know, for the new, this brand new temple, big temple of Vrindavan. So it was nice. In some respects, you got opportunities that would never have arisen in the West. You know, in the West, everything was being run. It was organized. You know, there was a hierarchical structure. That was it. So when I'd seen Prabhupada previously in Australia, where I joined, we saw him for 1 week a year. You know, when he would come every year, but for 1 week. So you get to see him, and you'd see him on the morning walk. If you were lucky, you could go on one morning walk. Yeah, they would choose who to go. You go on one morning walk, and then the rest you would just see Prabhupada, you know, Guru Puja and greeting the deities, and then the class, and that was it. But then in India, it was a whole different situation. So anyway, you know, somehow or another, I was told, you've got this couple of days. Harikesh, I found out later, really didn't want me on the party because he had seen me in action as the temple commander in Vrindavan, and he got this impression of me, you know, that I was like this ferocious guy who ran around shouting and yelling at everybody. And there were one or two incidents that had happened when Prabhupada was there during Janmashtami, which, you know, were called to his attention, which I think gave a rather unfavorable impression of my capabilities. I won't go into them now, but needless to say, Harikesh wasn't very impressed anyway. So when we were there in Delhi and Prabhupada had called him in, now Upendra's leaving tomorrow, who's going to do my massage? Then, you know, they were trying to think. Now, Tribhuvanath Prabhu, he was there at that time. He was part of the Delhi Yatra, which was very small. There was Ani Tejas and his wife, and Omkar and his wife, and a couple of brahmacharis. There was about 6 or 7 devotees in the whole yatra at that time. But they were very busy, you know, preaching, doing this and that. Prabhupada had seen me at the door, you know, sitting at his door as this guard. And so he had said, well, you know, what about this boy from Australia? And Harikesh had done his best to dissuade him. Yeah, no, I don't think he's really suitable, Srila Prabhupada. He's really new and like this. But Prabhupada apparently had said, no, he's here, so let him try. And then, you know, when I actually did my first massage, that was on the 27th, apparently afterwards Prabhupada came down and said, oh, he did a good massage. He was happy with it. So anyway, what happened was that couple of days was extended because when Prabhupada did meet with Nanda, I think on about the 29th, it was decided that, you know, he would go to Kurukshetra on the 1st of December. So when the plans were made for going to Kurukshetra, I remember I was massaging Prabhupada on the roof, and Gopal Krishna came up and asked Srila Prabhupada, who's going so that I can, you know, order the cars. And the first thing Prabhupada said was, well, he can go, meaning me. And Gopal was rather surprised. He said, Harry, sorry, Srila Prabhupada? And Prabhupada said, I have to get my massage. So that was it. I got, you know, a chance to travel with Prabhupada also. And in the meantime, the first day that I'd done the massage, Harikesh had made sure that as soon as the massage was over and Prabhupada had gone to bathe, he put me out the door. He didn't want me hanging around, and he didn't want me thinking that, you know, somehow or another I was Prabhupada's full-time servant. And I was happy. I mean, naturally, I was in ecstasy, actually. You know, I was just told, now come back in the evening, because there was the darshan in the afternoon. One of the nice things about being in Delhi was that for the afternoon darshan, I would take a rickshaw, a motor rickshaw, and I'd go to Chandi Chowk. And there was, you know, some big flower place there. And I buy the biggest garland that I could get, you know, like almost down to your feet, big, huge thing. And I bring that back every day whilst Prabhupada was in Delhi. And I give him that garland at the beginning of the darshan. So, a couple of days, Harikesh was cooking. So I very quickly figured that if I just hung around, he was too busy to kick me out. He did it the first day, but then the second day he was too busy. He was cooking. He had Prabhupada's lunch ready as soon as he'd finished bathing. So he kind of relented a little bit. And so I, you know, squeezed in there and, you know, I got the service of actually serving Prabhupada his plate. So Harikesh was cooking and he made the plates up and then I took it and I served it to Prabhupada. And he had this system, dawa system, like the Mawaris, where things had to be hot and fresh. So he was serving the plate, and then he had a little bell, and he would ring the bell when he wanted another chapati. So Harikesh had to stay in the kitchen, ready to cook another chapati. So I was the runner. So like this, for a couple of days, then I kind of, you know, got in there. And then in the evening, of course, there was the massage. So I'd come in at night time. And I remember going in that first evening at 9 o'clock. And Prabhupada had finished the darshan. And he was just very relaxed, you know, leaning back on the seat there on the bolsters and chatting a little bit with Hansa Dutta and Harikesh. And, you know, just generally it was a completely informal scene that I'd never experienced before with Srila Prabhupada. So it was a whole new aspect of devotional life that I had not seen before. And it was really wonderful, you know, to kind of be part of it, you know, to participate in it. So like I say, after a few days then, Nanda came. And then the arrangement was made to go to Kurukshetra. And then Prabhupada told me that, you know, he has to also come. So I got a chance to travel with him. So we went to Kurukshetra. We had a day there. I won't give all the details of that, but it was a kind of an interesting experience. We looked around Brahma Sarovar, which was the main area. If you go there, there's this huge lake. It must be about two-thirds of a mile long and about a third of a mile across. And that area was where Nanda was developing. He'd gotten $1.5 million or something, or $1 million from the government to redevelop the pilgrim facilities. So they were doing that, doing a lot of stuff. They took Prabhupada to see a new Gaushala. There was an whole irrigation and canal system that they'd built. There was an Ayurvedic pharmacy that we went to see. And then in the afternoon, they took Prabhupada to Kurukshetra University, where he placed some of his books there, like that. So then in the afternoon, mid-afternoon, then it was over. Prabhupada had seen whatever he wanted to see. Nanda left us, but we didn't go immediately back to Delhi. Prabhupada, he knew that there was another area of Kurukshetra which was not under Nandaji's. He had this organization called Manava Dharma. I think it means, you know, the Dharma of man. So they were doing the Brahma Sarovar area, but there was another area, Jyotisar, which was not under their purview, and it was about 7 miles further on. So Prabhupada, you know, yeah, shall we go and see Jyotisar as well? So everybody was enthusiastic. Ambarish Prabhu would come with us, and also Chaitaguru. And Gopal Krishna, of course, was there, and Harikesh. So off we went on our own to have a look around Jyotisar. And Jyotisar actually was more, we got more enthusiastic. The atmosphere there was very wonderful, very mode of goodness. It was a much smaller place. It was not being developed. There were hardly any pilgrims there. There was one small lake and a few small temples. So we looked around there for about 15, 20 minutes. And then Prabhupada asked us, what do you think about this place? And everybody was more enthusiastic about that, doing something in Jyotisar. Harikesh, you know, kind of expressed it. The other place is like the heavenly planets, but this is like Vaikuntha. Now, Prabhupada smiled, so he said, yes. He said, well, so let's try and get some land here also. And you can negotiate with Nanda on the other place. Because Nanda wanted to sell Prabhupada the land. And Prabhupada wanted him to give the land, you know, as a gift. So Chaitaguru was told to negotiate and to also try and get some place in Jyotisar. And then Prabhupada said, we can have a Krishna Arjuna temple here. And in the other place then, you know, we'll have this Vedic university or Varnashram university. So that was settled up. And then we drove back to Delhi. And the next morning we were due on the December the 2nd to travel to Vrindavan. And as I mentioned, that it was made very clear to me that that's it. Harikesh had, you know, already made an arrangement that when we got to Vrindavan, this devotee, Prituputra, French devotee, he was already told that you're going to be doing Prabhupada's massage when he comes to Vrindavan. So I was told, you know, that's it, you've had your couple of days, finish. And Gopal Krishna was constantly reminding me that as soon as you get back to Vrindavan, you can travel with Prabhupada's party back to Vrindavan, and you can stay long enough to pack your stuff, and then you can get on the train and go to Calcutta. So I was kind of, you know, okay, I was resigned to that, but I was naturally, you know, and I was just completely overwhelmed by the fact that I just spent the last couple of days massaging Srila Prabhupada and just being with him, you know. So on the first night that it had happened, actually, I'd gone out and I bought a blank notebook. There was a little shop on the corner of Bengali Markets, the new janitor bookstore. So after the first evening, when Upendra had, you know, shown me how to do the evening massage, when I came out, I ran down the road and I bought this blank notebook because I was thinking that, well, you know, 2 or 3 days I'll be massaging and being with Prabhupada. So I want to remember this. If I write it down, then in 10, 20 years' time, I'll be able to read those notes and remember all everything that had happened. So I got that notebook and I started keeping a few notes right from the first day. Anyway, as it happened, we got to Vrindavan. Prabhupada arrived, went, greeted the deities, gave class, came out from, you know, Guru Puja and class, and then when he came out, he went into his quarters, and Hasaduda went in as the secretary. Harikesh went in. He stood on the porch, There's a little veranda at the entrance. And, okay, Harry Ball. Here's Pritiputra. Pritiputra was with me at that point. And he said, now here's Pritiputra. You tell him how to do the massage. And Pritu, you come at 11:30. And Harry Ball, have a good, you know, trip to Calcutta for me. So that was it. So I had accidentally left Prabhupada's gumsha when we had gone to Kurukshetra. I didn't know that when he bathed, he would bathe in his gumsha. And then when he'd finished, he would wrap a towel around himself, and then he would drop his gumsha in the bucket. Because Prabhupada always liked to bathe out of buckets. That was his habit. So when I had gone in afterwards to clean up, I never thought about looking in the buckets because they weren't our buckets. They were from the hotel that we were staying in. So I didn't look inside. His gumsha was lying in the bottom of the bucket. So when we got to Vrindavan, I had to go and buy him another gumsha. So I took Pritiputra with me down to Loy Bazaar to get this gumsha. And on the way, I told him everything that had happened. Of course, you know, he was one of my friends. You know, I've been in the Vrindavan Yatra about 5 months, 4 or 5 months at that point. He was one of my friends. And Gunanava, Bhagavata Shraya, they were all there. When I had, you know, I'd gone off to Delhi for one day and then didn't come back. And then after 4 or 5 days, I'd come back with Prabhupada. They were all, you know, naturally amazed that, you know, what happened? You know, you went to Delhi and now, you know, you've been massaging Prabhupada like this. So they were all kind of quite amazed. And I told Prithu everything that had happened, the trip to, you know, Kurukshetra and what have you. I told him how to do the massage. He was naturally completely in ecstasy. And then we came back about 11 o'clock. And there's Harry Kesh on the veranda again. And he's looking very glum. And then he, you know, he looked at Prithu and he said, well, he said, I told Prabhupada that you were going to do the massage today. And Prabhupada got angry. And he said, no, why are you changing? He said, then constantly always changing. That means I am disturbed. He said, he was doing all right, meaning Harry Sori. So he said, why are you changing him? Let him continue. So, naturally, Pritiputra was completely deflated. And I, you know, I was completely in ecstasy. And that was it. And then Harry Kesh told me, he said, and not only that, he said, Prabhupada has told me now that you have to be given full-time servant's duties, not just the massage. So he said, get your stuff and move in. So that was it. I moved right into Prabhupada's rooms. You know, the servants had a little room just between Prabhupada's sitting room and his bedroom. So I moved right in there and, you know, became part of the team. Anyway, so then somehow or another, I ended up being there for about a year and a half. But there was one thing then on that first day in Vrindavan that really struck me very strongly. I got this very powerful, you know, kind of impression or realization about Srila Prabhupada. So I wrote that down. So it's extremely pleasurable to be with Prabhupada during these quiet moments. He is gentle and mild in his manner and completely fixed and steady in his devotion to Krishna. He has tremendous strength and force, but is devoid of passion. His presence is totally dominating without being at all domineering. His mind is steady and his senses are controlled effortlessly. His intelligence is perfectly clear, and he knows how to act and how others should act in every situation. His presence thus makes spiritual life a reality. Watching him today, it struck me that he is a living, breathing Bhagavatam. Whatever description of Krishna consciousness is there in his books, he himself is that. Reading his books brings gradual realization, but what is understood in perhaps several lifetimes of study is revealed on a second-to-second, minute-to-minute, day-to-day basis in Prabhupada's personal association. I've therefore resolved within myself to learn as much as I can while I have this matchless opportunity to observe him closely. simply watching Srila Prabhupada in his daily activities, how he deals with the devotees, how he responds to different situations, how he preaches, how he manages the worldwide affairs of his ever-expanding society, how he relaxes, how he continually pushes forward the movement of Lord Chaitanya, and how absolutely every facet of his being is fully Krishna conscious. It is quite feasible then to understand the full import of the sacred scriptures. By studying and preaching, one may make steady advancement. But at least for me, although I have full faith in Krishna consciousness, many ideas and principles are still only intellectually perceived, but not yet fully realized. But by observing Srila Prabhupada, I can see that they're a natural, integral part of his very being. So that was, you know, just the first real strong realization that I had. Here is the Bhagavatam alive, you know, sitting before me. And all I have to do is just observe Prabhupada in every, you know, circumstance and opportunity. And everything will, you know, just be manifest, what it means to be fully Krishna conscious. So that principle of living Bhagavatam then, Prabhupada mentioned that himself later on when we were in France. Prabhupada took his last world tour in 1976. He went to Australia and New Zealand, Fiji, Hawaii, came here to LA on June the 1st. He stayed for 10 days. We went to Detroit, Toronto, New Vrindavan, Washington, D.C., New York. That was the first Rath Yatra in New York in 1976, then to London, and then we went to France. And then from France we went to Tehran in Iran, and then we ended up back in Bombay in mid-August. So we were out for about 4 months. We set off in April and came back in August. So Prabhupada got to New Mayapur, and this was on August the 5th. There was a very nice scholar that was brought to see Srila Prabhupada. His name was Francois Chanique. He had written a very favorable review of Prabhupada's Bhagavad Gita Tal Calais. And the new French Bhagavatam had just come out a couple of days before. Bhagavan Prabhu had flown over to London with Prithiputra Swami. And they had presented to Prabhupada the first French printing of Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 1, Part 1. Prabhupada was extremely happy with that. And this man, Professor Chanique, he was also very happy with it. So when he came to see Prabhupada, he was actually on his way to a Buddhist retreat. But he stopped off for a few hours. He had his daughter with him. And when he came in, he was wearing a dhoti. And he had, you know, japamala around his neck. He had tilak on. He was a very nice man, very respectful to the devotees. So there were some preliminary introductions. Then Professor Chanique said that he was keen to see Prabhupada's Bhagavatam come into use. Means in the school system. He wanted it to be studied, actually, as a textbook in the universities. He said there's only one other French edition, which had been done in the 1800s, and that had no commentary. Yet, at the same time, at the university level, he said the French are meticulous about maintaining the standards of grammar of their language. He was politely concerned that our translations should not smell of English, as he put it. He felt that since our books were translated from the English, the French literary expression was not always exactly correct. Describing French as a more compact language than English, he wondered whether it might not be better to translate directly from the Sanskrit into French. Srila Prabhupada was not very concerned, while acknowledging that if possible, improvements can be made to future editions. So if there's anybody that has any doubts that Prabhupada wanted his books edited, there's one example where Prabhupada said improvements should be made in future editions. He realized that there's always some mistakes and, you know, corrections that have to be made. So anyway, he told this French professor, he explained that as yet, no French devotee had yet become a Sanskritist. But besides that, he said, it's not a question of scholarship. The translator must be a realized soul. He said that although there are many Sanskrit scholars in India, they cannot understand the Srimad Bhagavatam. He must be French, expert in language, at the same time a devotee. Then he can explain. Otherwise, no. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's secretary, Swarup Damodar, he asked that Bhagavat Paragya, Bhagavat Stane, you go and study the Bhagavat from the Bhagavat. I have discussed this in the beginning of the translation of Bhagavat. So, Bhagavat, that is the limit of education. Vidya Bhagavata Vidhi. One has to study and take education up to the Bhagavatam. That is, if one understands the Bhagavatam, then he has finished his education. The professor assured Srila Prabhupada that he wasn't in any way criticizing, but he was concerned that Prabhupada got the widest possible audience. He felt that an improvement in the way the French editions were written would ensure that. Srila Prabhupada appreciated his concern, but he continued to stress his point. That is from the scholarship point of view, he said. But our point is that this Bhagavat must be presented by the Bhagavat. And there is not much scholarship required. Just like the Bhagavat begins with the word Jamma Jasya Jata. So this Sanskrit word means that the absolute truth is that from which everything emanates. Now, that absolute truth is further explained. Anvayadi taratascha abhigyasvarat. The absolute truth is aware of everything, directly and indirectly, of all of this creation. So in this way, if you step-by-step study, then it is not a very difficult thing so far as the word meanings are concerned. But it is a question of realization. Unless one is realized, he cannot explain properly. That is the secret. Therefore, we have given the life of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu in our Bhagavat because he is the living Bhagavatam. So that was nice. Prabhupada gave his own view of the living Bhagavatam there. And of course, as Chaitanya Mahaprabhu's representative, Srila Prabhupada was also the living Bhagavatam. Yeah. If Prabhupada's books had come, and they actually came here before Srila Prabhupada himself. Yeah. When Prabhupada arrived, he went to Philadelphia University after he'd been in Butler. And he went there to sell his books. And they were already there. And at several places in New York also, they already had Prabhupada's books. Because I think he had a book distribution agent. And they had sold 17 sets of Prabhupada's books to some American organization. Either at the consulate there in Delhi or I don't know exactly what it was. But when Prabhupada arrived in America, his books were already there. So that was, you know, portentous, I think. But anyway, if Prabhupada's books had just come by themselves, undoubtedly, you know, a few people would have read them. But without Prabhupada's personal presence, what would they have meant? You know, who would have actually taken up Krishna consciousness? You know, what temples would have been established? What devotional service would have gone on? There would be nothing. It was all dependent on Prabhupada himself personally coming and living the Bhagavatam. And because he lived the life of a devotee, then that immediately had, you know, a powerful effect on people that came in touch with him. So the books are there, but it also has to be expressed, what's in the books, by action. That's an acharya. He speaks nicely. And he also acts nicely. Prabhupada said somebody can speak nicely, but if he doesn't act, or if somebody behaves nicely, but he doesn't know what to say, then you don't get any effect. But an acharya means that he speaks nicely and he acts nicely. So that was Srila Prabhupada. He was the acharya of the Bhagavatam. He was the living Bhagavatam. So from Prabhupada's example, and of course, as I said, that everything in ISKCON is molded exactly the way that Prabhupada wanted it. Or at least every aspect of ISKCON, you know, Prabhupada established a standard, you know, for that. Standard of behavior, standard of diet, you know, standard of you know, deity worship and devotional activity, you know, book distribution, whatever, everything, kirtan standards, every single aspect of devotional life Prabhupada gave us. He thought about it very carefully, and ISKCON grew on that basis. So basically, you know, if we want to maintain everything, we have to do that with reference to Srila Prabhupada, to the way that he lived the Bhagavatam. That is the, you know, that will be successful, without a doubt. There may be others that have their own standards and their own ideas, you know, about how to practice devotional life. But Srila Prabhupada, you know, was the founder acharya of ISKCON. He's the one who spread Krishna consciousness all over the world. He's the one who Krishna empowered to establish those standards. Yeah, the pertinent standards for becoming a pure devotee, whether you're in America, whether you're in Europe, whether you're in Africa, whether you're in Australia, whether you're in Japan or China, wherever it is. But those standards are what will transform us if we follow them into pure devotees, which was Prabhupada's only intention. He wanted to raise, you know, the conditioned souls up to the Vishuddha Sattva platform. So anyway, this seminar then is an attempt to present, as I say, a glimpse of Srila Prabhupada's activities, the standards that he set in various aspects of devotional life. So there are a number of topics that I've kind of compiled, you know, some information on. Chanting is one of them. Prasadam is another one. Cleanliness. Health, temple worship, and deities, temples like that. What else? Oh, books, book writing. I haven't put one together on book distribution yet because that's all already so well documented that I haven't bothered with that one at this point. But book writing, there's a lot of very interesting insights about Srila Prabhupada's inspirations, about his qualification for writing his books and the instructions that he gave to others also for writing. So that one's an interesting one. So what I thought it would be nice to do is to ask all of you which topic you want to hear about. Let me just pull up all the topics again. Because, I mean, I can arbitrarily pick a topic. That's not a problem. But if you have a particular interest, it's nice if everybody's, you know, in agreement on what they want to hear about. So what we've got one on living in the Dham. That's mainly about living in Vrindavan. That's a fairly short one. Let's see what else we got. And then, as I say, there's health, there's chanting, there's books, there's cleanliness. Okay, so let's look at those. I'm going to give out the headings and then everybody can vote. We'll do it that way. I think that's easier. So, book writing. Srila Prabhupada's efforts, you know, in writing the Bhagavatam, his inspiration, all that, you know, his qualifications. So anybody who wants to hear about book writing, Prabhupada's book writing, put your hands up. Okay, one, two, three. Next one, chanting. That one's quite a long one. All right, we have a majority. There's no point in going on with any of the other titles. There's cleanliness. No, you can't vote for two at once. You have to vote for one topic. One. Health. That one's quite a long one. Prasadam pastimes. That one's prasadam. The whole idea of taking prasadam, serving prasadam, cooking prasadam, you know, just one. Anyway, the chanters have it. I did chanting when I was here last time. You got a good memory. So there may be some that have already heard the chanting seminar. Maybe who heard the chanting seminar before? All right, so there's four or five of you. So do you want to pick another one instead? You voted for health. All right, but there's prasadam, pastimes. That one's quite a long one. Living in the Dham. No. Deities and temples. That's a shorter one. It's kind of interesting. Huh? All right. Book writing. We had a couple of votes for that before. Okay, so where do we stand now? all right, we've eliminated chanting. So, health. Do we want to do health? Okay, so we'll do health. That sounds like I just did that one when I was in Sydney last week. But anyway, it's a good one. Okay, so we'll have a look at health. This is in different sections. There's Prabhupada's an overview of the way that Prabhupada, you know, dealt with his own health, or rather health problems, lack of health. There's he had a philosophical approach to it. Because when I travel with Prabhupada, that was 76. He left us in 1977. So his health wasn't good the whole time that I was with him. But actually, right from the very beginning, when he came to the West, he was beset with various health problems. Because he had those heart attacks on the boat. Again, he had a massive heart attack in 1967. Which put him in hospital and paralyzed him, actually, down one side for some period of time. Caused all kinds of problems for him for many months. Then, so apart from the heart problems, and he would have regular heart palpitations, things like that, he was also suffering from anemia, which was caused by one of his kidneys that was diseased. I think the other one also was not functioning very well, so he had a very severely diseased kidney, and that would cause his whole body sometimes to swell up, his arms and legs. Maybe every month or 2 months that would occur. That's a very, very painful condition. Then he would get very high blood pressure. There was one time it was so bad that he couldn't actually give his class because that blood pressure was, you know, giving him too much problems. He had problems with digestion continually because, you know, when you're old, you just can't digest things very nicely. So he was always adjusting his diet. If you can't digest properly, that means that the food, instead of giving health, turns to poison. It acts like poison within the body because it's not digested. It doesn't break down. So it causes all kinds of problems. You get imbalances of air and mucus, and that can cause, you know, very serious problems as well. So Prabhupada always had a lot of mucus problems. Yeah, you can hear a lot of his tapes, Ekanathnos. You listen to Prabhupada's conversations in classes, sometimes it's very thick because he's always got so much mucus. So, and then another problem was toothache. He had toothache repeatedly all the time that I was with him. I have a tooth of Prabhupada's, which I worship every day. So that tooth fell out one evening when we were in Bombay. Prabhupada just put it in his drawer and continued on with his work. So toothache was a big problem. His teeth used to move, actually, when he would clean them with a toothpick. They would move apart. All of them. They were all loose. And then another problem was diabetes. That was something that Prabhupada never mentioned to me, actually, specifically. He never told me that, well, I have diabetes, so I have to adjust my diet. He just never mentioned it. But I knew he had diabetes, you know, from previous. And I think all he was doing for that really was just adjusting his diet. And sometimes I did see him sit, one time at least in Delhi, he had chana and chini. Chana and chini means, chana means fresh curd or paneer, yeah, from milk. So he had a bowl of that, and then he had a bowl of sugar, chini, just straight sugar. And he was dipping in with a spoon, a spoonful of sugar, spoonful of cheese, like this. I don't know whether that was because of his diabetes, you know, but sometimes Prabhupada was known to dip into a whole sugar bowl. So, you know, there were all these various ailments that Srila Prabhupada had. And apart from that, he was old. I mean, physically, he was getting old. He was traveling, you know, beyond the capacity of even a young person, practically. So that was also wearing him out. You know, all his bodily organs going up in the aircraft, coming down again. You know, constantly changing from one time zone to another. So it was all very difficult. Now, this is the beginning of arati. We have a choice. We can have the arati, and I'll finish and continue tomorrow night. Or we can continue on. We'll begin this seminar tonight, and we'll go till 9 o'clock. So everybody has to tell me right now what you want to do. Everybody that wants to continue, put your hands up. Everybody that wants to have the arati, one man. Sorry, outvoted. This is also kirtan. All right, so we'll continue on. Sri Sri Rukmini Dwarkadish Ki Jai, Gwanitai Ki Jai, Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Devi Ki Jai. So apologies to the regular kirtaniyas. We'll continue on with this Bhagavat Katha, the living Bhagavat Katha. So, okay, let's have a look at Prabhupada's health. As I said, so we'll start with a little glimpse of Prabhupada's kind of philosophical approach to health. Then we'll look at, you know, specifically all these different health problems that Prabhupada was experiencing. And then we'll have a look at Prabhupada's advice to devotees and how they should deal with their own health problems. And there was a difference between the way that he dealt with his own health and the way that he advised other devotees to deal with theirs. So there were a couple of occasions when Prabhupada, you know, expressed his, you know, his feeling about his health. On February the 26th, 1977, Prabhupada was in Mayapur. Now, this was just before he got really seriously ill at the Mayapur festival in 77. And he never really recovered from that illness. So there was a gradual build-up to this point. So this was maybe 2 days before he got really, really sick. So in the evening, he was sitting on his asana with the lights turned down very low out on the veranda of the Lotus building. Tamal Krishna Maharaj, Pradyumna and myself were present. I was giving Prabhupada some medicine that he is taking for his kidney, and he pulled a face because it was bitter. He laughed, and then he told us that as a child, it took 3 men to hold him down to give him any medicine. Sometimes when I was angry, he said, I would take these hookahs and smash them on the ground. So apparently in his parents' house, they had these hookahs. You know, they're like water pipes. And Prabhupada said he would get really angry sometimes and smash them. So Trivikram Maharaj was there. He'd just come by. So he asked Srila Prabhupada whether his mother would try to stop him. So he grinned and he said, then I would take another one and smash that too. Anyway, the point was that he, you know, he said, I never liked taking medicine, you know, and his parents would have to force him practically. So on August the 15th, 1976, this was the same day that he lost this tooth that I have upstairs. Prabhupada had curtailed his usual walk on Juhu Beach. Whenever he was in Juhu, he would always like to go and walk down the beach. It's very extensive, nice and flat. And there was one gentleman that used to join him every morning. That was Dr. Patel. Dr. Patel was quite notorious in the Bombay Yatra. He was a nice man, but he was very boisterous and very loud. He was a little man, less than 5 feet tall, I think. When Prabhupada had first got the Juhu Beach property, and, you know, he began taking his walks down the beach there, this Dr. Patel and his friends, they would also take their morning walks. It's a popular exercise in India. Many people, they go out at dawn and they walk. So Prabhupada was doing that. Dr. Patel saw Srila Prabhupada on the beach he was curious. He saw, you know, so many Western Vaishnavs with this sadhu. So he went over and introduced himself and began to walk. And then from then on, he became more or less Prabhupada's constant walking companion in Bombay. It was good for him because he was a Mayavadi when he first met Prabhupada. Yeah, which most people are. In India, the impersonal idea is practically 100%. Everybody has it. So he was no different. And he was also, he was actually good at Sanskrit. He knew Sanskrit quite well. So he used to read regularly Bhagavad Gita and like this. And he would get into these debates with Srila Prabhupada. And he would argue his Mayavadi point of view. And Prabhupada would smash him. You know, every argument that he brought up, you know, or observations that he would make about Indian history or Indian politicians or the state of Indian society, Srila Prabhupada would always give him another angle on it, but, you know, from the devotional point of view. So after a couple of years, Dr. Patel, you know, he started reading Prabhupada's books. So by the time I first met him, which was at the end of 75, Dr. Patel was practically a bhakta. You know, he accepted Prabhupada as his guru. But it wasn't quite the same way. I mean, he'd been converted, you know. But it wasn't quite the same relationship that we, you know, young Westerners had. We were, you know, in awe and reverence. We were there to do anything that Prabhupada, you know, bid us to do. You know, Prabhupada's word, that was it. But Dr. Patel, he liked to argue. You know, if there was some, you know, question that he had or some philosophical misunderstanding that he had, he would get into these debates with Srila Prabhupada, and sometimes he'd get really pushy and he would be really loud and try to, you know, speak down or speak over Srila Prabhupada. So sometimes the devotees would get a little agitated with him, you know, because of his, you know, his kind of very boisterous nature. But Srila Prabhupada liked him very much. He was always very respectful to him and friendly with him, and that was really what won him over. So, anyway, we'd arrived back from Tehran on August the 13th in the evening. And Prabhupada had been having this problem with his kidneys. He'd had this swelling of his arms and legs, this edema. And so he was not feeling well enough to go on his morning walk. So Dr. Patel then, he came to the temple. This was in Prabhupada's old quarters. If you go to Bombay now, unfortunately, they've demolished every building that used to be there, including Prabhupada's old quarters. When we first got Juhu Beach, there were six blocks of flats, two stories high, and Prabhupada had an extra floor built on each block. And then he occupied the top floor of one of those blocks of flats at the back of Hare Krishna land. A couple of years ago, they did this expansion. They've just opened that now, this last Ram Nomi, I think. And unfortunately, for the expansion of the temple, they demolished all the old buildings, including Prabhupada's old quarters, which personally I didn't think was a very good idea. I thought they should have preserved it. But anyway, that's progress. Anyway, so Prabhupada was up there, and instead of going down to Juhu Beach for his morning walk, he decided to just go on the roof and walk up and down the roof. So Dr. Patel arrived, having curtailed his usual walk on the beach because he didn't see Srila Prabhupada by the sea. He knew Prabhupada was in town, but he didn't see him. So he came over, and he quickly inquired from Prabhupada about his health and whether he was taking any medicine. Now, Dr. Patel was an allopathic doctor, and he had a lot of faith in, you know, medical science and just generally material science, modern material science. And they would, that was another, you know, point of debate, that Prabhupada would not give him the credit or give, you know, the scientists the credit that Dr. Patel used to like to give them. So that was, you know, something that didn't really go well with Dr. Patel all the time. He thought Prabhupada was a little bit harsh in his judgment. So anyway, he asked Prabhupada, are you taking any medicine? So Prabhupada accepted his concern, but in his usual self-effacing manner, he shook his head and he quoted the Srimad Bhagavatam 10.1.4, saying that the real medicine is the chanting of the holy name. Nivritta Tarsha Upagiyamanad. This chanting is properly done by a person who is fully satisfied in his material desires, satiated, no more, bhavoshadi, and this is the medicine for this bhava roga, means the punabhava, that once you take your birth, then you die, and then punabhava. So this is the bhava roga. So roga means disease condition. So the disease condition of material existence. So except this pashugna, this animal killer, nobody can be aloof from the chanting of the Hare Krishna mantra. It is bhavoshadi, means the medicine. So Dr. Patel left. So then shall we call that Pandit Ayurvedacharya of the whole of India for you, if you don't believe in our medicine? So he was saying, if you don't want to take my allopathic medicine, do we have to bring the biggest doctor in the whole of India before you'll take some medicine? So Prabhupada laughed. He said, no, no. What I mean to say, Dr. Patel continued, is that the chetra, the body, and the chetragya, the owner, are dependent on each other. If there's no chetra, then there'll be no chetragya to stay there. So you've got to look after the chetra. Or what will the chetragya be happy there to live in? I think I'm not wrong. So Prabhupada chuckled. So he's saying, if you've got a body, you have to maintain it. Yeah, it's the duty. So Prabhupada chuckled. He said, no, you're right. But this chetra is changeable. The chetragya, that is permanent. So although Dr. Patel knew very well Srila Prabhupada's opinion on taking medicine, he still tried some friendly persuasion, and this led to a short discussion about Indian medicines. Dr. Patel said that there was now a research plant in Calcutta that is extracting penicillin from cow dung. Prabhupada knew about it, and he added that Dr. Manmohan Ghosh, a pathologist of Dr. Jagadish Chandra Bose, had conducted the original research proving the antiseptic properties of gobar. Dr. Patel said that there were many medicinal properties in cow urine also. Gomutra, sir, there are so many hormones coming, and a big sample of those hormones which can be resynthesized as human hormones. And Prabhupada agreed. He said that if you drink gomutra, then it is good medicine for liver disease. Dr. Patel expressed his concern again for Prabhupada's own health. Taking permission to raise his question, he asked, now, then, Arjuna was so advised that he should fight it out. So in that case, I mean, we all consider that he was right to follow Krishna's advice. So then if a man is overtaken by disease and if he fights that out, so Prabhupada smiled at his persistence. No, no, I don't say that he should not fight. It is my personal choice. Not that one should not take care of the body or one should not eat medicine. It's not that, but I like this, that let me do without medicine. That is my personal choice. Oh, what is medicine? Dr. Patel asked. Any herb is a medicine. Even food is a medicine. Whatever it may be, Prabhupada said, I don't decry medicine. That's not my business. No, no, I don't say decry, Dr. Patel replied, but you don't want to take advantage of medicine. Medicine, Prabhupada said objectively, just like a type of vairagya, sometimes they do not eat. So that does not mean that eating is forbidden. It is not, but this is my personal. I am trying to avoid it, that's all. You have heard the name of W.C. Banerjee? So he was a big barrister. He was one of the three inaugurators of Congress Party in the beginning. So he had a friend, a contemporary. He was a brahmana. So he was taking his daily bath in the Ganges. And if he was diseased, he was simply drinking Ganges water. So he became seriously sick. So this W.C. Banerjee, he was a big man. So he asked his permission, let me bring some doctor. You'll die otherwise in this way. So the man persisted, no, I shall simply drink this Ganges water. So it is not that medical science is in the defeated position. So that was Prabhupada's mood, that it was his choice. Yeah, medicine's all right, he's not decrying it, but he personally chose not to use it unless he was in some kind of extreme circumstance or need. It's not that he never took medicine, but on the whole, if he could tolerate, you know, a physical condition without bothering with medicine, That was his preference. So naturally, that sometimes made it a little difficult, at least for us servants and any doctors even that were sometimes called. Because we knew, you know, Prabhupada would get sick, and sometimes very seriously so. But still, he wouldn't take any medicine, even if he let us go and buy it. I knew very well if we bought some medicine, and it happened a couple of times, you know, Prabhupada would go through the motions. And then when it actually came to taking it, he would say, no, I'm just going to chant. So that was it. He was, you know, from a medical point of view, Prabhupada was probably considered to be a very difficult patient. Anyway, so again, this mood of relying on Krishna, Prabhupada expressed that when we were in Jagannath Puri on January 25th of 1977. He'd gone to Bhubaneswar to open or to do the groundbreaking ceremony and the foundation stone ceremony for the Bhubaneswar temple there. And during the middle of that visit to Bhubaneswar, he spent 2 days in Jagannath Puri. So the first day was the 25th of January. And we were having a talk, chit-chat, in Prabhupada's room. He was staying in a place called Tourist Bungalow Number 1. It's right by the seaside. Gagamuni Swami had rented a little room so that he could, you know, have a rest there and have his massage, and we could cook for him. So we were talking. So Prabhupada was telling us, so long the body is there, then there'll be so many troubles. And Krishna has advised that they will come and go, so don't care for them. That's all. Matraspashas tu kontiya, sitoshna sukadukada, agamapayino nichas, tamstitikshashva bharata. So bodily, mental, by enemies, so many impediments will come. What can be done? We have to tolerate. This is the material world. We cannot expect it to be smooth or very happy. That is not possible. Krishna is advising Arjuna what to speak of us. So what are we in comparison to Arjuna? He is his personal friend, talking with him. And he says, tamstitikshashva. Krishna never says, oh, I have some magic, you'll have no failure, just like that. No, tamstitikshashva. You just try to tolerate. That's all. He never gave him some tablet. Prabhupada was laughing. He taught that. So we have to do that. As these modern gurus say, oh, I'll give you some ash, there'll be no trouble. So, Krishna, did he say so? He said, no, you just simply tolerate, that's all. He could have said, I'll give you some ash. You are an ass, and I'll give you some ash. Neither Arjuna asked, oh, why are you asking me to fight? Give me some ash, and I'll throw it. No, he was not such a fool that he asked for some magic from Krishna to kill his enemies. Actually, he fought. So this is the Bhagavad Gita. So face things as they are and depend on Krishna. That is our duty. We must go on with our duty and don't expect any ash or miracle or magic. Yeah. So again, that's the philosophical. You have to look at what your body really is and what the material world really is. And what we really are. So again, Prabhupada on this point about not, you know, taking any medical help where he could avoid it. We were in November of 76. We were in Vrindavan. At this point, we just got the news about the first big court case against ISKCON. That was in New York. Adi Keshava, who was the temple president there, and Tridas. They'd been arrested and charged with brainwashing, kidnapping, and extortion. And Basu Gopal Prabhu and Murti Vandya, I think her name was, these two devotees, they had been actually taken away from the temple by court order and put under psychiatric observation. And there was to be a big court case. So it was the first real challenge to ISKCON's existence as a legal and religious entity. And so we were in Prabhupada's room. We were just chit-chatting about that. There was one devotee in Vrindavan. His name was Bhagatji. He lived right next door to the temple. And when Prabhupada got that land there in Vrindavan, Bhagatji was one of the few, maybe the only local man to come forward and give his help. So Prabhupada built the Krishna Balaram Mandir. Bhagatji donated 1 lakh of rupees and also the land next to the property that we got for the temple, which became the Gurukul, Vrindavan Gurukul land. So that was given by Bhagatji plus 1 lakh of rupees. And Bhagatji was also involved in the management. He was helping the devotees, you know, with the financial management because he was a local man and he knew how everything worked there. So Prabhupada was very happy with him. And whenever Prabhupada came to Vrindavan, Bhagatji would come and he would cook his bread, as he called it, his rotis for lunch. And he would also come in the evening and he would prepare Prabhupada's glass of hot milk. Every evening Prabhupada would drink some hot milk. And Bhagatji then, he was doing that and he would come in with the milk and then he would sit and chit-chat with Prabhupada. So we were having a bit of a talk in Prabhupada's room. This was probably about 9:30 in the evening. Normally Prabhupada doesn't like to eat with others around to distract his attention, but this evening as he ate some potato pakoras and a little subject that his cooks had prepared for him, he allowed myself and Hansaduta to join him and Bhagatji with some light conversation. His mood was jovial and accommodating, and as he enjoyed the simple fare, he glorified the simple life of Krishna consciousness, wondering how anybody could possibly find fault with it. Some papers, newspapers that is, have put a critical tone on their reports about how the devotees are spending everything on God and nothing on themselves. So they didn't like that. They thought that, you know, that was some kind of exploitation. So Prabhupada was wondering how anybody could possibly find fault with that. So is it not a credit, he said? We are spending for God. We are the servants of God. We want to see God gorgeously situated. And for us, we have no comforts. We don't care for any comfort. We simply spend the minimum just to keep the body and soul together. That's all. So this is our principle. We don't spend a farthing for our sense gratification. He thought that this was a strong point in our favor for the court case. So this should be noted down. If some case is there, then we should be. This should be presented. That we don't go to restaurant. We don't go to cinema. We don't spend lavishly for dress or something else. No. Looking around at us, sitting on the floor in his almost vacant darshan room, he laughed. Neither for furniture either. It just had some, you know, cotton mats and that was it. One table, bas, no furniture. So, if you sit down on a pad, is that faulty? We sit down, we don't use any chair or any couches, unnecessarily, carpets. So, what expenditure? We have no expenditure for the personal self. And still, oh, you are faulty. So what can be done? We don't purchase any cosmetic. This clay tilak is sufficient. We don't apply this pomade or cosmetic or ointment, either for our girls or ourselves. We don't do that. We live very simply. After 15 days, we shave the head, and there's no use of cutting or decorating. So you note down all of these things. And we have no doctor's bill, even. At least I save on the doctor's bill, he said with a chuckle. I am always sick, but I never go to the doctor. You just give me a little neem, give me a little this or that, then what expenditure shall we make? As far as possible, we do not even go to the doctor. So again, that was Prabhupada's determination. He didn't like actually, you know, dealing with doctors. Of course, Prabhupada was a pharmacist in his, you know, before he took sannyas and took up full-time preaching. That was how he was earning his living. So he knew the whole medical industry, at least in India. He knew it inside out. He was a pharmacist. He was making medicine. He was selling others' medicine. So he knew everything. You know, it wasn't out of ignorance or some, you know, superstition. Prabhupada knew it more thoroughly than, you know, many doctors did, actually. In fact, I had a couple of cases where I got sick. A doctor was called, and they gave the diagnosis, and then afterwards Prabhupada said, this is bogus. And he diagnosed me, and it was actually, he was correct. Anyway, so this is Prabhupada's approach. Again, another expression of that occurred on November the 5th, 1970, 6 when we were in Vrindavan. The previous month been down in Hyderabad, and Prabhupada had opened the new Hyderabad temple. That was at Janmashtami. And during that visit, he had a meeting with all the cabinet ministers of the state of Andhra Pradesh, the state government. So they'd all gathered in the home of the Minister of Endowments. He was, because in Andhra Pradesh they had nationalized all the temples. That's where the Tirupati temple is. Tirupati was getting lakhs and crores of rupees every month, you know, given to the deity. And there were some reports that the trustees were misusing that money for themselves. So the government, they wanted the money. So they stepped in, they nationalized all the temples so that they could get control of Tirupati temple. And so this man, the Minister of Endowment, Sagi Surya Narayan, he was a nice man actually, pious. And he was concerned, you know, how to use the money of Tirupati for the benefit of the people like this. So he was asking Prabhupada for advice, how that Balaji's Dakshina, that should be utilized properly. And Prabhupada had a lot of ideas about that. And he had given a talk, actually, to all the cabinet ministers in the state of Andhra Pradesh. So they were very respectful. It was very nice. That was in contrast, actually, to what was going on in the rest of the country, where the communists were up on the rise, and they were agitating in the Indian parliament that ISKCON is a front for the CIA. Yeah? They had observed, here's this old Indian sadhu, Jai Shishi Gonitai, Shishi Rukmini Dwarkadi, Shishi Jagannath Baladev Subhadra Devi Kijai. They had observed, here's this old Indian sadhu. Nobody had ever heard of him. He goes to America. After a couple of years, he comes back. He's got unlimited money. And he's got all these young Americans running around all over the country. You know, they're in Calcutta, they're in Delhi, they're in Bombay, they're in Hyderabad, all over the place. What are they up to? How did he get so much money? Must be the CIA. Yeah? All these Americans, they're all CIA agents, and he's receiving so much money from the American government. This is the propaganda that was going on, and people believed it. It was in the newspapers, it was in the Indian parliament, the question was called. So Prabhupada was kind of dealing with that, but at least in Andhra Pradesh, the government there, they accepted, you know, he's genuine sadhu. They liked ISKCON. They were impressed with the new temple that had been opened there. So then, a month or two later, Prabhupada's in Vrindavan, and this gentleman came. He was a member of parliament from Hyderabad. So he came to see Prabhupada, and he told Prabhupada how he had received a grant from the government. Maybe this, you can give us something to eat or put a dummy in the mouth. He had received a grant from the government of 25 lakhs of rupees, which was in those days $250,000. It was quite a lot of money. And he was going to open a yoga club, which he said would specialize in reviving ancient medicines for bodily health. Prabhupada patiently heard him, and then he told him quite candidly, ancient or new, it doesn't matter as long as it does the job. By yoga, you can develop the ability to walk on water. But why bother when you can pay a few paisa and cross it by boat? So he wasn't really impressed with that. Concentration on bodily health, he said, is simply a waste of time. Even the animals know how to look after their bodies. He gave the example of the mongoose, which when fighting with a snake, runs off into the jungle if it gets bitten. There, it finds a certain herb which it eats, which counteracts the venom of the snake, and then again it comes back to fight. So even the animals, he said, know how to look after their bodies. He said, therefore, we should take care of the soul within the body first. Again, he wasn't against keeping good health. But, it, you know, if that's all you're concerned with, your focus is in the wrong place. The focus has to be on the soul. The body is there as something that you utilize for your spiritual advancement. That's all. But it's practical. It's limited and it's temporary. Bas. You have to understand that. So, again, then the mood was, the holy names are the real medicine. So January the 5th, 1976, Prabhupada was in Nellore in South India. Again, we'd gone down there to ostensibly start a new temple. Some land had been apparently donated to us and Prabhupada, by two sisters. And Prabhupada was staying on that land. He did the foundation stone ceremony. We were having a big pandal every evening. About 6,000 people a night were attending the pandal. And they were making hundreds of life members on the promise that we were going to build a temple there. Unfortunately, that never eventuated, because later on it was discovered that these two sisters were actually trying to cheat ISKCON. They had donated this land, but in the deed of gift, they had put some conditions which our men, when they signed the deed of gift, the receipt of it, they had not checked all the conditions. And, you know, these conditions, basically, Prabhupada, when he read it, he understood this is a trick. They want ISKCON to come in and build, and then at a certain point, under the conditions, if the buildings were not completed, they wanted a temple, a comparative studies library, and a meditation hall. These three things were specified. And everything had to be built within 3 years. And if somehow or another the buildings weren't complete within 3 years, then it could be taken back and then donated to some other charitable institution or mission, such as, you know, a well-known mission in Calcutta. So Prabhupada understood what they're going to do, because we're the only ones that had the money to build. So at that time, he said, we're the only ones that are building new temples. So these ladies, they've fallen under the influence of these people from this particular mission. Now, we'll come in, we'll start building, and then somehow or another, by some trickery, they'll stop us from completion. And then when the 3 years is up, they'll take that by law. They'll be able to take the land and the buildings and give it to this other mission. They'll complete it, and then they'll have a nice facility at ISKCON's expense. So Prabhupada was, even though he had put in an antashesha and the foundation stone ceremony on this visit, afterwards he ordered the devotees to dig it up. He actually had them dig up the antashesha and take the foundation stone to Madras when these ladies refused to change the conditions on their so-called gift. Anyway, that was the background. So this particular day, Prabhupada was out on a morning walk, and there was one Mr. Reddy, who was the president, I think, of the local Rotary Club, either Rotary or Lions. I think it was the Rotary Club. So he was coming out. He was very interested. ISKCON was a new organization in Nellore. And, you know, there was a lot of publicity in the newspapers. The devotees were going out chanting every day in the main streets. People were, you know, quite excited. All the foreign sadhus are here, like this. So it was a big thing. And Prabhupada actually spoke also at the Rotary Club. But they really didn't know that much about us. So Mr. Reddy mentioned on the morning walk that the government was distributing land to the untouchable class, the Dalits, or the Bungi colony there. So he asked whether ISKCON was engaged in any kind of social welfare work, because many people had asked him, what exactly does our society do for the benefit of others? Prabhupada replied by asking him, what do you consider to be the best social welfare? When Mr. Reddy said that serving the poor and the natives, Prabhupada told him, everybody is poor. Who is rich? First of all, he said, you find out, who is rich? Prabhupada went on to explain that everybody is poor because all of us must suffer from disease, old age, and death. An adjustment of a person's material condition, that can be done by anybody. But ISKCON was established for a different purpose. These things, he said, are being done by so many other people. So we are doing something which is ultimate. The hospital is giving some medicine when there's some disease. But that does not mean that there will be no disease. Can they guarantee that I'll give you this medicine, now you'll have no more disease? No, but we are giving that medicine, that no more disease. So this is the best social work. As soon as you give up this body, chakwa dayam panajanma nayati. you will have no more birth. And if you have no more birth, there'll be no more death. If you have no more birth, then there'll be no more disease. So this is our prescription. Chakwadayam pranajanma naiti mamati. So not that he is finished. No, he goes back home, back to Godhead. So this is our program. Again, the bhavoshadi. This is the real medicine. This is the treat the disease of the soul. If you don't have to take another material birth, there's no question of having to bother with the doctors anymore. You get your spiritual body. So that was Prabhupada's broader view. So that's like the philosophical angles that Prabhupada was looking at. Now we'll have a look, a little look at some of the problems that Srila Prabhupada had to face, you know, during his life. Of course, when we were traveling with Prabhupada, sometimes he would talk about his days before ISKCON. At this time, 1976, there was no Leelamrita. So we had no, you know, detailed biography of Srila Prabhupada. There were, you know, we had like a general history, but we really didn't know much about the details of Prabhupada's pre-ISKCON existence. And so whenever Prabhupada would talk about that, of course it was nectar, and we would always try to draw out as much as we could, you know, find out as many details as we could about his previous life. So occasionally Prabhupada mentioned about some difficulties. Although Prabhupada himself, he never liked to talk about what illnesses he had. He would just tolerate them. He never complained about them. It was only when they were really extreme that, you know, he would call us in and tell us and, you know, maybe allow us to bring a doctor. But otherwise, he was just very, very tolerant. So anyway, this particular time, September of 76, we were in Vrindavan, and Prabhupada was suffering from very heavy blood pressure, high blood pressure. In the evenings, sometimes he was having me come and massage his head, and he asked for this Brahmi oil. So this Brahmi plant, that is supposed to be very good for the brain. So in India you can buy, or you used to be able to buy, small bottles of Brahmi oil. It's a green oil. And it massaged Prabhupada's head with that. And then he had me get a gumsha and soak it in cold water. And he put that on his head. And then he would sit there in the evenings and chant with this thing on his head to kind of reduce the pressure. So anyway, this particular day, September the 5th, he'd had a management meeting. In India, Prabhupada was always heavily involved in the management. In the West, everything was being done by his disciples, and he was quite happy with that. But in India, you know, we really didn't know much about living in India. We were all Westerners mainly at that time. There were very few Indian, full-time Indian devotees. And so Prabhupada basically had to do everything himself. He had to oversee every little detail. And especially with Vrindavan. He had opened the temple on Ram Navami in 1975. Because building it was in itself a huge endeavor. You know, fraught with so many anxieties and problems. But somehow or another it was opened. But then after that, every time Prabhupada visited, he would see, this is wrong, that's wrong, this is not being done right. Spending too much money, you know, on the flowers, on the prasadam, everything. So he would get heavily involved in all of the managerial problems there. So this one particular evening, we've been having a management meeting. And so reports of this nature, coupled with his management problems, are really too much for Srila Prabhupada. He began to rub his head and he complained. He said, now I am getting brain fag. So I was puzzled. I'd never heard that term before. And I asked him, brain fag, Srila Prabhupada, what does that mean? So Prabhupada repeated, brain fag. And then he told us a story how one time in Delhi in the 1950s, he was walking all over from one office to another trying to distribute his Back to Godhead newspaper. The entire production of the newspaper, writing, editing, proofreading, purchase of the paper, overseeing the printing, and all the distribution was simply being done by himself alone with no assistance from anyone. He said he was working very hard. So once, while out in the hot sun, he developed brain fag, and he said, I began to reel like a drunkard. reeling, you know, from side to side. But he had no money even to stop a taxi. Fortunately, by Krishna's arrangement, just at that moment, a friend of his happened to pass by in a motor car and saw him. So he took him to his home, he gave him some medicine, and then that cured it. So he got heat stroke, brain fag. Brain fag means nothing stops working. So that was one example. You're having your BBT meetings, and here's Bhrigu Patty, is one of our, you know, oldest book distributors. Prabhupada was also. There's nothing that Prabhupada's disciples are doing that Prabhupada didn't do himself. Everything. Book production, writing, distributing the works. He did the whole lot. So up to this extent where he was even collapsing in the street, but still, you know, he was so determined to go out and sell his back to Godhead. So that was one example. He got that in the 1950s. Another example of some illness that he had in the 50s. Again, we were talking in his room October the 3rd, 1976, Vrindavan. I had had some questions based on one devotee. He was reading one of the original Indian editions of Prabhupada's Bhagavatam, first canto, first part. And I glanced in the front, and it said that it had been published by the League of Devotees. So I was very curious. I had no idea, you know, who the League of Devotees were or, you know, what they were. But they were the publishers of Prabhupada's first book. And it listed, you know, Prabhupada's residence in Vrindavan and his office in Delhi. So, you know, it was an opportunity. I mentioned it to Prabhupada, you know, that we have this book. And what had happened was I'd gotten a picture of Prabhupada when he took sannyas. Yeah, there's that picture of Keshava Maharaj sitting down, and then either side there's Srila Prabhupada, and there's this Bhaktivedanta Muni Maharaj, who was an old man that took sannyas at the same time. So I'd gotten that picture, and I took it in and showed it to Prabhupada. Prabhupada was, you know, very curious. He said, it's not a good photo. He didn't like it particularly himself. But anyway, so it gave me the opportunity to ask, you know, about that situation. And Prabhupada started talking about how he'd left home and gone to Jhansi to preach. Then this godbrother, Keshava Maharaj, you know, told him to come to Vrindavan. So he'd stayed there for some time like that. So I was curious about what the League of Devotees was. So I asked him, was that some godbrothers that you had joined up with or what? So he said, no, after leaving Jhansi, I went to this godbrother, pointing to the photo of Keshava Maharaj. I lived there for a few months. That was in Mathura. Then I went to another godbrother, that Imlital in Delhi. So then I left there. I left there. And then I used to live alone in Delhi. Then I took one house in Kasigat. So that was at the Bamsi Gopal temple. One room he had on the roof right behind the Kasigat palace. So then these Radhadamodar men, then they called me. So you can live here. We'll give you two rooms. You don't. We don't charge. We'll just give you the place. Then I came to Radhadamodar, and from Radhadamodar temple, then I went to the USA. So then I asked again, well, I was just wondering exactly what was the League of Devotees. So Prabhupada started smiling. Oh, the League. That was, well, I was trying to collect some devotees. Some of them, they were medical students. So they came and they used to live with me. But still, I lived there for 2 years, Jhansi, from 1954 to 1956. So I had some surgical operation on my testicles, and they were taking care of me. So then he mentioned this, Prabhakara Acharya. He was Prabhupada's first initiated disciple. He was given the name Haridas. So he was initiated sometime 55 or 56. And then Prabhupada didn't initiate anybody else until he came to America in 65, 66. Anyway, so it's interesting. Prabhupada mentioned there that he actually had an operation during that period in Jhansi, and it must have been quite serious. And the medical students that were attending his classes, they were also looking after him. So some, you know, ongoing problems were there. At that time, 1956, Prabhupada would have just been about 60 years old. Yeah, so 50s, when you get to your 50s, Prabhupada said, that's when you have to really start maintaining your body. When you're young, it kind of regenerates. It's not such a much of a problem. But when you get in your 50s, you really start going down. So therefore, it requires more maintenance. And if you look at Srila Prabhupada's day, he spent at least three and a half hours every day simply maintaining his body. Although he wasn't keen on medicines, but it's not that he was neglecting his body either. Morning walk, 1 hour. Noon massage, 1.5 hours. That's a full body massage with oils. Evening massage, another half, 1 hour. So that's at least three and a half hours every day, just maintenance. And then on top of that, of course, adjusting the diet, for proper digestion, etc. So Prabhupada was very conscious about looking after his body, but he just didn't like taking medicine. That was the thing. Anyway, so he mentioned then to us when we were in Jagannath Puri in 77, Gagamuni was there, Satsarup Maharaj was there, and again we were talking, and he began to talk about the early days when he first came to America. And so he was telling us, he was explaining the word apratiyata. He said, pratiyata means checking. So when your devotional service will make progress in spite of checking, that is pure devotional. Ahaituki apratiyata, yayatma supersediti. This is pure devotion. I was attacked by that heart attack thrice. On the ship, twice. So now he began to refer. So it's interesting, he used himself as an example of unchecked devotional service. So he said, I had that heart attack twice on the boat, when he left India, two nights running. So Gagamuni said, oh, on the ship, twice. So Prabhupada said, yes, consecutively, 2 days attack. Actually, I would have died on the ship before reaching your country. I could not understand that it was a heart attack. The pain was so severe that I thought, I am now dying. And it was done in 2 nights. And I was very much afraid that on the third night, that if this night also, again, some pain, then I shall die. But the third night, the pain did not come. It was suspended. It came in New York. So you know that. This left side was paralyzed. So that was Prabhupada's view. He had 2 heart attacks on the boat, but then the third night, actually when we were here in Los Angeles in June of 76, Prabhupada referred to this and he said that on that third night, instead of having the heart attack again, and he said, here, I would have died if it had come again. It was so severe. He said, rather, he had a dream. And he saw Krishna in his dream, in his many forms, rowing the boat. Yeah, and he said, then he knew that everything was going to be all right. And in fact, the rest of the whole trip across the Atlantic, the captain, Pandya, he said that he'd never had such a smooth crossing of the Atlantic in 40 years as a captain. So he wanted Prabhupada to stay on the boat so that he would have a good trip again. Anyway, so Krishna took care of him. But then Prabhupada said it was postponed. Yeah, and that came in 67. So he had that massive heart attack in New York. And he was actually paralyzed down his left side. I mean, when I came on the party at the end of 75, there was no, apparent debilitation from that at all. So somehow or another, people have strokes. Sometimes you see them, they remain paralyzed. The face or droops down or they get some numbness or they can't move their arm properly or their leg or whatever. Prabhupada was like that. But somehow or another, he got over it. And the reason why, Gagamuni recalled, he said, yes, he said, down the left side, we had to massage you constantly. So this is actually the way to cure that paralysis. In the West, they'll only give a stroke patient medicine. Somehow or another, trying to fix it with medicine. But they never think about massage. Yeah, because it's labor intensive, that's why. Nobody's going to do it constantly. But if somebody has a stroke, becomes paralyzed, if you massage, then that will actually be the most effective way to cure it, to get everything working again. You must get the circulation going again, and get the muscles, stop them atrophying, and etc. So Gagamuni said, yes, we were massaging you constantly. And Prabhupada said, yes, but they were arranging for some operation. And I told Kirtanananda, you just give me massage. Garga Muni said, yes, I can remember. I wheeled you down for the test. And there's a very funny description of that incident. I think it's in Gurudas Prabhu's book, where Prabhupada was up in his room, and then the doctor said, now we have to go for tests. And they wanted to inspect his brain. That's what really alarmed Prabhupada. They did some blood tests. They did an epidural, which is an injection into the spine, draw some fluids out, and they actually wanted to look inside Prabhupada's brain. So when Prabhupada understood that, he just told the devotees, get me out of here. And he told the doctors, no, I'm all right. You don't have to do anything. So he had, you know, these trolleys that they lay you down on and they wheel you around. Prabhupada was sitting on the trolley chanting, and Garga Muni was pushing him down the corridors. Prabhupada's chanting away. And then they took him in this room. The doctors came in, and the doctors were really heavy. They told, you know, Sasarup Garga Muni, they told them, now, you know, he's refusing to have these tests. He's going to die. If you don't, you know, consent to have him tested, he's going to die, and you're going to be responsible for killing him. They were really, you know, they were just young boys. They just met Prabhupada a year before. And, you know, they didn't know anything. So the doctors were there getting very heavy. And Prabhupada was saying, get me out of here, like this. Garga Muni wheeled him out, and he was running down the corridor with Prabhupada sitting on the trolley chanting. He got lost, actually. He couldn't find the room. You know, they got here and there. Finally, they got in the room, and then Prabhupada checked himself out. So then they made him sign a form, indemnity, that we're not responsible if anything happens. Anyway, it was a heavy period, but Prabhupada was very, very sick. So Garga Muni said, yes, I can remember. I wheeled you down for the test. Prabhupada said, yes, the heart was also very painful still. Garga Muni said, they wanted to take some blood, and I had to stop them. And Prabhupada said, yes, they were examining my brain, and I thought, I must go away. I told him, doctor, I am all right. I can go. Garga Muni said, yes, they wanted to do so many tests they wanted to take from the spine. And Satsarup said, well, they did that. They gave you that spine needle. So Prabhupada said, never call a doctor. Never give me the hospital. You let me die peacefully if I am in trouble. And that was a refrain that we heard many times from Prabhupada, especially in the last year. Never take me to the doctor. Now, never take me to the hospital, especially. He didn't want to be put in a hospital. And then, of course, just before this, we just heard that one of Prabhupada's leading godbrothers, Tirtha Maharaj, he just left his body. And the news was that he had been in Mayapur. Then he was taken very seriously ill. So they rushed him to the hospital in Calcutta. And then they put so many tubes and machines and like this. And he died after a couple of days. In a coma, then he died. So what good did it do him? Prabhupada said he could not even die like a gentleman. He was very sorry that they had done that. They should have just left him in Mayapur and let him leave his body there. So Prabhupada warned us, don't do like that. So Garga Muni was just mentioning, yes, this Tirtha Maharaj, he had many doctors. Prabhupada shook his head. He said, he has suffered too much. When I was in Los Angeles, after coming back from India in that quarter, do you remember? West Pico Boulevard. So yes, he said, so I was continuing my disease up to there. So after Prabhupada got out of the hospital, the devotees took him, I think, to New Jersey for recuperation. Then from there, he ended up, after some time, he went back to India because he felt that he wouldn't be able to recuperate unless he went back there. And he took some Ayurvedic medicine when he was in Vrindavan. He stayed there for some time. Then again, he came back to the West. And he came here to the West Coast. But even when he came back, and at that time, the temple here in L.A. was in West Pico Boulevard. So even then, Prabhupada said the disease was continuing. So it wasn't just like a heart attack and then it was over. This was months that he was suffering from, you know, heavy problems from that. So he said, I was staying in one house, actually many houses, so I was not sleeping at night, and there was some sound, gong, 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 in my ear, constantly, like this. So then again, he brought this same topic up. We were in Vrindavan in September 20th, 1976. Again, he was describing the same incident. He said, I got that heart attack. Then he said, I went to Stinson Beach. There I could not improve my health. No, first I went to San Francisco. There I could not sleep at night. There was a throbbing in the heart. Kirtananda, he was serving me. And there were so many difficulties. Then I came back to India in July of 67. There also, no improvement. Then again, I went to Los Angeles. And then this symptom developed. Always some sound in the ear. Gong, 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 gong. It was so disturbing. Almost half mad. And that despite that, the Krishna consciousness movement was just beginning to expand. So Prabhupada had to deal with all these new devotees that didn't know a thing about what they were doing practically. He was establishing the temples. He was getting, you know, he was still writing his books. And at the same time, all with this business going on, all this mad sound in his ears, his heart was throbbing and, you know, so much weakness. But he was so determined to just keep on going. Just really, I mean, amazing. Anyway, so this thing about the hospitals, as I said, many times Prabhupada brought this up. March the 5th, 1977, this was, Prabhupada had been very, very sick for about 5 or 6 days. And it was just right at the very beginning of the Mayapur festival. Prabhupada came down the first day, but he looked really ill. And then at the end of the program, which he didn't speak, he had the GBCs give the class. He went back up to his room and then he told us, he said, now no more visitors. Nobody is to come. And he spent about 6 days just lying on his back practically. Sometimes on the bed, sometimes on the floor. I don't think he hardly ate anything for that 6 days. Very, very high temperature. Another problem developed where he couldn't pass urine. Some blockage was there in the urinary tract. He couldn't pass urine. So, I mean, with that, how long are you going to live if you can't pass urine? So we had to get immediately some big Ayurvedic doctor from Calcutta. He came. What was his name? Bimala Tarakatirtha, something like that. He came and he immediately said, give him hot dob juice. Dob means green coconut. So we had to heat up green coconut on a flame and then open it up when the juice was still hot. And Prabhupada drank that. And immediately, within 12 hours, it cleared the blockage. Because then that gave him another problem, because it gave him dysentery. But anyway, so, you know, it was a very difficult period. And Prabhupada had this really high temperature. Then by the, March the 5th, Prabhupada's temperature has returned to normal this morning. Dr. Ghosh, who was his old friend from Allahabad, he was a doctor. Prabhupada had his pharmacy there, so he was one of the people that he used to sell medicine to. So he was old, but he was told Prabhupada's very ill, and please come. So he came to Mayapur, and he prescribed several Western medicines. He is well-meaning, but he is in illusion, thinking that medical science can at least prolong one's life. At one point, he suggested that the best thing would be for Srila Prabhupada to go to Bombay and enter a clinic there, where they have a machine which can suck out all one's blood, clean it, and then put it back in again. Nobody responded when he mentioned it. He made this suggestion. No, everybody just kept quiet. After he'd gone out of the room, Prabhupada told us that Tirtha Maharaj had died in a machine with all these tubes. And he mimicked another godbrother, Akinchana Krishnadas Babaji, who had come to him afterwards and described Tirtha Maharaj's leaving, that, oh, he had all the most up-to-date methods. And Prabhupada said it very sarcastically, because his godbrother had said, oh, he had all the up-to-date methods. Still he died. You know, what good was that? He was very proud of this, Prabhupada said sarcastically. He admonished us very strongly, once again, that we should not disturb him with this, and that he wanted to die without the hospital. Then again, this was a little after I left the party. I left Prabhupada's party in March of 1977. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he had just come on as Prabhupada's permanent secretary. And when I left, I told him that, you know, Maharaj had been keeping this diary. And now, you know, if with me not being here, if nobody keeps a diary, so many different pastimes of Prabhupada are going to be lost. You know, I said, what do we know now from all the previous years? You know, when different, you know, Nanda Kumar, Shruta Kirti, so many, Purushottam, so many other servants have been there, Nittai. Nobody's ever written anything down. And so many, you know, activities that Prabhupada did, now we don't know about them. So I said, you know, you really got to keep a diary. So he was saying, oh, you know, I'm too busy. I'm the secretary. I've got so much I have to do. I won't have the time. So I really pushed him. I said, Maharaj, you must do this. It's very, very important. You know, otherwise these pastimes will be gone. Nobody will know about them. So he said, all right, well, I'll see. You know. So he didn't promise, but he said, I'll see. If you look at Tamal Krishna Maharaj's diary, mine finishes in mid-March. That was when I left the party, March 13th. His diary picks up around about April the 19th in Bombay. So for the first month, he didn't do anything. But that something clicked when they were in Bombay there, and he suddenly realized, yeah, there are a lot of important things going on, and nobody's recording it. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj started keeping his diary, and he did that right up until the end, up until Prabhupada's disappearance. So from his notes then, again, several mentions this, Prabhupada telling them, don't take me to the hospital. This was on April the 29th, 1977. They were in Bombay. So Prabhupada was telling him, he said, this has been a great history, the formation of ISKCON. So never mind now. He said, from my part, whatever is possible means I have done. So now you take care. That is my request. Don't spoil it. Now it is up to you. This ailment, I can pass away at any time. My health is not good. I'm an old man. So it is not surprising. Now you GBC, you young boys, all American, expert, you've got all intelligence and resources, so don't spoil it. Let the movement go forward more and more. Now you've got nice places filled with devotees. So you don't be anxious for me. That Krishna will take. And even if I go, what is the harm? Old man, I have given my ideas and my directions in my books. So people appreciate, I think. From my side, I have done everything. Is it not? Do you think or not? Tamal told him, yes. He said, you have done everything. So, you're all young men, American boys. But still we want the whole Bhagavatam, Srila Prabhupada. That will be done. But even if it is not fulfilled, there is no harm. But don't send me in any case to the hospital. Now I am pointing this out. They are useless. Tamal said, there's no doubt that you know your body a lot better than anybody else could ever know it. You've lived in it for so many years. They just take somebody's body and then they make so many experiments. So Prabhupada said, yes, that's a fact. So hospital failure. So that was one, again, another warning. And then just shortly after that, another week later, they were in Rishikesh. Prabhupada had gone there to spend some time in a life member's house. Then again, he got very sick in Rishikesh, and then he had to rush back to Vrindavan. And so whilst they were in Rishikesh, Prabhupada was telling Tamal Krishna again, he said, this is my request, that even if I remain unconscious, yeah, but never put me in the hospital. You can refuse. No, this is our Guru Maharaj's order. Just chant Hare Krishna, Bas, and let me die peacefully. Then Tamal Krishna said, well, when Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was unconscious, all that his disciples did was that they would chant in his ear. Prabhupada said, yes, that's all. So we will take that example. Please don't ever doubt it. We will never let them. It will be over my dead body. This is Tamal speaking. Prabhupada said, this is my order. If I become unconscious, that was it. So it was an order from Prabhupada. No hospitals, just chant Hare Krishna. Later in the year, of course, then, Prabhupada was taken back to Vrindavan, that last 6 weeks, right at the beginning of October. So we'd been there for about 7 or 8 days. Again, this topic, same thing came up. Prabhupada was, at that time, of course, his body at that time was finished. It was completely emaciated. He had not eaten anything solid for about 3 months. He was drinking some Complan, this kind of nutritious drink, and a little fruit juice, sometimes some milk. But the milk also was causing problems from mucus. So he was just simply drinking, you know, maybe a cup or 2 cups of liquid a day. That was it. So you can imagine the state of his body. He was simply skin and bone. He had no strength even just to roll over in the bed by himself. He had to be moved, even for any simple movement to sit up or anything. So Prabhupada, we had bought this big bed, which you can see now. It's still there, Prabhupada's rooms. And we bought that especially for this return journey. So Prabhupada was lying on the bed, and we'd started this 24-hour kirtan. So he was telling us, two songs especially, Chintamani Prakarashadmashu, that means Brahma Samhita, and Hare Krishna Maha Mantra. These should be continued, as well as any song, but especially, I mean to say, here in this room. So you want to drink something now, Prabhupada, Tamal asked. When I shall want, you can give me just Charanamrita. So we can give you now. Would you like it now? No, I'm not thirsty now. But Charanamrita, a little can be given sometimes. No harm. But don't take me to the hospital. No, Prabhupada, under no circumstances. Even if you are unconscious, we will simply chant. Yes, I am quite all right here. That we can see. I came back from London on account of this hospital. So what had happened, actually, there was one trip to the hospital that they did make. That was on Prabhupada's visit to, his last visit to London at Janmashtami time. And again, he got this problem, not being able to pass urine, some blockage. So it was an emergency. And of course, they had no Ayurvedic doctor to consult. So they had to do something. So they brought this man, I think his name was McGregor, very nice Scottish doctor. So he diagnosed that Prabhupada's kidney was fully diseased, finished. And he said that there's some scar tissue in his urinary tract, which is preventing this passing of urine. We can do a minor operation, small thing, and it will relieve him. So they discussed it with Prabhupada, and Prabhupada agreed. They took him to the hospital. Then just when they wheeled him into the room, it immediately cleared. So then Prabhupada said, "Now I'm relieved." So then they had to think, well, what to do? If we go back, but again, the same problem may come. We may be in a circumstance we can't do anything about it. Now we're here. It's a minor operation. So let's go ahead. So Tamal Krishna Maharaj made the decision to go ahead with that. Prabhupada consented. So they did the operation. But now you can see here, in October, a couple of months later, you know, because Prabhupada said, immediately after that occurred, then Prabhupada said, let's go back. He had a plan. He was going to go, actually, from London. He was going to come to America, and he was going to spend some time at Gita Nagari, because he wanted to establish Varnashram in ISKCON. And he said, this will be the new phase of this movement. And I had actually received a letter in Australia from him. He had made me the GBC there at that time. And I'd written to him about our new Govardhan farm. And Prabhupada had written back and said, yes, this is very nice, simple living, you know, high thinking. He said, now this is my plan. I want to make all these farming communities very strong. So he had a plan. He was going to travel again, but only to the farming communities and spend time in each one and establish those communities. But then when this problem occurred in London, then he said, no, let's go back. So now he was saying, so I came back from London on account of this hospital. Means the threat, you know, the danger that, again, something might happen, and then again, they'll take me in the hospital. He knew in India, at least, there's a chance. No hospitals. So anyway, there were a couple of other occasions when Prabhupada mentioned again during that last month, two or three occasions, where he repeated the same thing. No, I've already explained. I don't want to go to the hospital. And again, Tamal Krishna Maharaj telling him, you know, I absolutely assure you it will be over my dead body. If, you know, they'll never take you to the hospital. So that was the situation actually on October the 18th, there's a quote here from Tamal. So he was telling Srila Prabhupada, so one thing is that you don't feel able to sleep. So that's a bad thing. And the other thing is you're being in so weak condition, so your willpower becomes weakened. Your determination is weakened. So as far as these two problems go, for sleeping, I know that something can be given to help you sleep. As far as willpower, if you allow us to take care of you, then I think that that should be the willpower. Of course, I mean that we're not going to let them do anything bad. I mean, I'm not going to let anybody take you to the hospital. I wouldn't have done it in London except that you yourself said that we should do it. Otherwise, your instructions is told to everybody. Don't let them take me to a hospital. So we are not thinking like that. So again, he was reassuring Srila Prabhupada. You don't have to worry about anything. There's never going to be a question at the hospital. Okay, it's getting a little late. It's quarter past nine. We went on a bit more than I thought we would. But we'll continue on tomorrow evening. Same time, 7 o'clock. If we have permission from the evening Sankirtan ears, the Kirtan men, that we can continue on, then we maybe I'll do another hour and a half or so. There'll be another session on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock or 10:30. I think it's on the schedule for an hour and a half. And then I think also on Monday morning, again, instead of the Bhagavatam class, we'll do this Srila Prabhupada, the living Bhagavatam. Same thing. We'll do that again on Monday morning. After that, I'm not sure. We may do something during next week. I'm leaving on the 30th, which I think is the Wednesday. Is it? Wednesday or Thursday? So we'll see. I may go to San Diego or I may stay here. But anyway, so I hope that you've all enjoyed hearing a little bit about Srila Prabhupada. Any quick questions or comments before we finish? Brigo. Yes.
So, I just want to ask that in the Kanta Rita Bhakti Group, Prabhupada, in the Surabha Haridasa Thakur, Prabhupada gives an instruction in one of the booklets out. Haridasa Thakur was a Mukta Purush, he came 192 rounds a day. We can't imitate him, but we could follow in his footsteps by chanting 16 rounds in front of Tulsi. And in that booklet, he felt familiar with it. He goes on to elaborate.
Well, he was chanting on Tulsi. His beads were made from Tulsi. That's the same thing, isn't it? If you're chanting on Tulsi, if you're sitting before Tulsi, what's the difference? So, yeah. I mean, Prabhupada, that Yogendra rest, now that you mention it, that was a medicine that Prabhupada was taking on a daily basis when I first joined the party. But after a couple of months, he stopped taking it. Then, when he got really sick later in the year, for a couple of days, he revived that. Now, Yogendra Ras, of course, I'm not expert at Ayurvedic medicine, but I understood that was something for the brain. Little red pills with some silver and other things mixed in, and we would crush that. We would crush a large roasted cardamom pod and then crush that with the Yogendra Ras tablet or pill and then mix that with honey. And Prabhupada would take that every morning just before his morning walk, at least for some time. So it obviously had some good effect, but there was a point at which he stopped that when I was with him. And then, yeah, the massage. But we'll talk about the massage a little bit on the later session. All right? Okay, we better finish. It's very late. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.